7, Whiskey Papa Mike, 7.
All right, we had three stations in there, and I got two of the three, which is passing in my book, but I did miss the double. So I did copy KG7ZCW and Evan KG7WPM, but I missed the station in the middle there. Who did I miss?
W7EFS.
All right, Tony. Good to hear you in there as well. Sorry, I missed out on the first call there. So KG7ZCW, W7EFS, KG7WPM. We'll start at the top with KG7ZCW. Go ahead with your question on APRS.
Last night I was on Echo Link talking to a truck driver, and he told me about this website, APRS.fi. I got on there and I thought that was really cool. But my question is there some kind of software or hardware that is required for you to be tracked on this website?
Good question. We have talked about APRS before, and I think maybe going to the Kavara.org website, looking up APRS basics is one of the links you can read up on a little bit. But I would love to discuss this again, because this is one of my favorite parts of amateur radio is APRS. We launch high-altitude balloons, and that's how we track where the balloons fly. I think our highest confirmed altitude was 96,000 feet above sea level, almost, no, 98,000 feet. I can't even remember. Anyway, that's how we track the altitude and where it's traveling, where it lands, and all that stuff is with APRS. So, again, one of my favorite aspects of amateur radio. Let me let the system drop here, and we'll talk about hardware and software. APRS is used to transmit real-time data. Information records the exact location of a person or object via a data signal sent over amateur radio frequencies. In addition to real-time position recording capabilities, using an attached GPS receiver, APRS is also capable of transmitting a wide variety of data, including weather reports, short text messages, radio direction finding bearings, telemetry data, and short email messages, and storm forecast. So basically there's three types of APRS stations, and you got to know what you want to do so you know what hardware or software or both you will need. So the three basic types of APRS stations is a basic station or a node, then there's a digipeater, and there's an iGate. So if you want to just be plotted on the map to show yourself on APRS.fi, or there's another one, I can't remember the name of it. Basically, you have to have a GPS and either an internet connection, like some smartphones will actually plot you right on the map. And I'll even turn mine on right now. So I'm going to turn on my smartphone app. If you go to APRS.fi and search for the call sign K1RR-9, you'll see where I'm located in Northwest Spokane, Washington. And that's being done right off my smartphone, which has a built-in GPS receiver, and it also is connected directly to the internet. So all it's doing is using the APRS app that I have and plotting my position directly on the map. Now that's fun and that's cool, but I actually got the chance to meet the inventor, the author of APRS, W4APR is his call sign. And he really, he thinks that's cool that we can do it with apps nowadays, but the best way to do it is to actually send it over the airwaves. So if you want to do that via RF, which is how most of the stations operate, you would get a radio that can transmit. We use the 2 meter frequency is 144.390. And you can get a radio that is APRS ready. So it's got a bit in TNC. That stands for a terminal node controller. So basically all you do is plug in your GPS to it, and it's ready to rock and roll. If you don't have an APRS ready radio, then you will need an external TNC. The TNC terminal node controller is basically just a little tiny PC board that integrates the audio to your radio and pulls the information from your GPS device and adds all the packet data to be sent out over the airwaves. So again, you can run just a smartphone with a GPS. You can run an APRS ready radio that's set to the APRS frequency. Or if you just have any other kind of 2 meter radio, then you would have an external TNC, which you can find at Bionics is a good website, BYONICS.com. But yeah, there's all kinds of different APRS TNCs that you can get for any radio that'll transmit on 2 meters. So hopefully I haven't confused you too much. I'm going to turn it back over to you and see if that answered the basic question of what you need to get on the air with APRS.
Absolutely. That was very helpful, sir. I appreciate it. And yeah, I'm pretty much looking at your front door right now. Yeah, just a really cool thing I learned last night about the hobby and wanted to kind of get into it and was wondering what I needed to do it. So yeah, that was very helpful. I appreciate it, sir. KG7ZCW monitoring.
Well, good. Yeah, and there's other stations. You can set up your own digipeater. You can become an iGate. So say I'm out in the middle of the woods, and my radio sends out a beacon, basically sends my location and whatever short message I want to send out. If I can't be heard directly by an iGate, which stands for an internet gateway, what it'll do is any digipeater that can hear me picks up that signal and then just quickly stores it and then rebroadcasts it out again. So it's just like a repeater up on a mountaintop, only it's made just for APRS, so they call them digipeters. And your signal will actually bounce from digipeter to digipeter to digipeter until it's picked up by an iGate or an internet gateway, which is the point where it actually plots you on the map. So there's way more in depth that we can go, and anytime you have any questions about APRS, give me a shout. Like I said, it's one of my favorite parts of the hobby, but yeah, we could go in a lot deeper to APRS, but I just wanted to kind of get you set up there with the basics, and feel free to take a look at some of our notes from the previous APRS discussion. And if you have any other questions, please call back in. We'd love to hear other questions as well, so thanks for being there. K1RR here. Let's go to Tony, W7EFS. Good evening, Tony.
Hey, good evening, Glenn. By golly, great stuff there. I recognize you as an expert there on APRS. There's just you and several of the other people I've met there, Steve and Dan and others there involved with the balloon launches. And talking to Steve at breakfast Saturday morning, I learned a lot more about using two balloons instead of one. You guys have experience, and I really appreciate that. My question deals with seasonal icing of antennas and how the icing affects both reception and transmission. We've got the Nanum Ridge repeater, for instance, and some people that normally had good signals to that had very weak signals to it during the morning nets. And I'm wondering if you could kind of generally describe the problems from icing on antennas and, you know, different kinds of icing, whether it's a simple frost or 1/4 inch of water ice, for instance. W7EFS, thank you.
Well, thanks, Tony. but this is something that I have absolutely no experience or answers with, which is fun because I get to learn something as well. I can tell you that getting up on Mica Peak and other repeater sites that I've been to, there are different types of ice, and that's for sure. You get the raindrops that come down and freeze, just like freezing rain, and covers an antenna. And then you get the fog and the clouds blowing over at 6,000 feet and just freezes to the antenna and becomes a big, like a big block of almost like dry ice attached to the antenna. I know that painting your antennas black, non-metallic black cover, really, really helps when you're at 6,000 feet elevation, because when the sun comes out, it melts the ice a lot quicker that way. But as for what it does to propagation, I have not a clue. I'm hoping John, W7OE, or Jim, M7WRR, are hanging out here this evening, and they would probably have more information on it than I would. So let's stand by and see if John or Jim is still hanging around here this evening and could give us their opinions on propagation through icing.
I don't have much to add. I could make a comment or two. That's 7WRR.
Well, that's what I'm hoping for there, Jim. This is something I don't have an answer to. I can't even guess what the propagation is like through ice. So, yeah, go ahead with your comments.
I don't either, but I know it's the storage thing that is a problem, not only if it builds up enough eventual damage to the antenna, but can kind of change the SWR quite a bit too. And one of the best solutions, I haven't tried it because I haven't had that problem, but one of the guys that had quite a few repeaters going up over the mountain, not part of our group, he used to use tool dips that he would put on the outside of the antennas. It was a kind of a rubberized material he painted on it that gives quite a bit of protection and insulates the antenna from some of the things the ice would do if it built up, but greatly restricted the ice building up. And I haven't tried that, but he was using it, some of the high repeaters up in the Cascades, that it works pretty well. N7WRR.
Well, thanks, Jim. Yeah, I know that sometimes different repeaters I'll get multi-path where I don't normally get that, especially throughout the dead of winter. And I just assume it probably has something to do with icing as well. But, like what we did down at the Elk Butte repeater, we just used a standard 2-meter 440 antenna, and Bob, KF7WOR, built a really nice PVC pipe with an end cap at the top and open at the bottom, and had notches cut out for the radials. It has small radials at the bottom of the antenna, and he just slid that PVC pipe right over the top of the antenna. And I don't know whether that actually helps or with icing, but it sure does make the antenna, the PVC is a lot stronger than the antenna, so it's a big ice ball that weighs 10, 15, 20 pounds built up at the top, it's not as likely to grab that antenna and bend it over till it snaps and breaks. But the antenna up at Stensgar Mountain, like I said, is actually painted black. And when just a little bit of sun comes out, of course, black attracts the heat and white doesn't. So being a darker shade tends to really reduce or speed up the process of thawing out when there is ice buildup. So There you go, Tony. That's all I have, and I'm glad Jim was there for his comments. Back to you.
Thank you both, Glenn and Jim. That's very informative stuff there. Just another brief question, please. You say paint it black. What I understand, you know, it absorbs the incoming radiation, heats up a little bit more. Is there a preferred type of paint that would be more radio transparent than others? I like keeping things kind of low visual profile there, so that really appeals to me. W7EFS.
Comment. Yeah, go ahead, Jim.
Well, my memory's not so good anymore. I depend on Betsy for that a lot. I can't remember the guy's call sign that was doing that, but that tool dip, he would just paint on, and it was a rubberized coating, and it was a dielectric that didn't conduct at all. So you just paint everything with it. And it was kind of a rubberized coating, and so it was a little thicker than normal paint, and he would use dark colors, black if he could get it, to get dark blue and keep away from the orange, and put that on him. And that works pretty well. I guess you could put you know, get some paint out, put a ohmmeter on it to see if it conducted at all. But I think most of those rubberized paints are pretty much non-conductive so that you can paint them over everything. M7WRR.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. That's good information. I would just say, you know, anything, that's another step you could take it is throw an ohmmeter, a very sensitive ohmmeter on it and see if it conducts anything. Obviously, you want to stay away from your 1960s lead-based paints in your front room, not because lead's a hazardous material or anything, but obviously your radio signal trying to propagate through lead's a little difficult. And of course, anything with a metallic coating, you don't want any super pretty metal flake in your paint. But I would just play with it, and of course, test SWR before and after, and make sure that you haven't changed anything at least from that part of it. So that's what I would suggest. So I think that's great information. Back to you, Tony. K1RR.
Thank you so much. I'll try to investigate and track down a product with those characteristics there. And Jim, thanks for letting me sit with you and Betsy at the table there after the Hamfest in September. That was a real pleasure for me, at least. W7EFS. Thank you, Glenn.
I didn't even catch the gentleman's name. I should probably just look him up on QRZ right now. The station KG7ZCW, which is a really cool call sign. KG7ZCW. Dan. If you do get into one other thing I wanted to mention, if you do get an app for your phone just to play around with it, they're going to require a password for using the APRS system. And don't email whoever they say to email to get your password, because it takes way too long. When you get to that point, just let me know. I can get you a password for the APRS system. So one other point I wanted to make real quick. All right, we have Mike waiting there. I heard him on D-Star on the other end while we were talking about the other topics. Let's send it over to Mike, KG7WPM from K1RR. Go ahead there, Evan.
Set off and I'll miss him, Glenn. Mike and I get our call from time.
Yeah, I had two questions, if you don't mind. I guess just to ask, confirm me, I'm coming through, okay, if you don't. This is KG7WTM.
So, we got you in there just one. I think the whole gallons per minute and words per minute threw me off, but you guys are the per minute guys. So, you're coming through just fine. Go ahead there, Evan.
I guess on my EchoLink project that I was talking to you about, you know, you have the different antenna connectors. It's just a small little box I'm building, so I'm going with SMA or RP-SMA. And the little connectors, the soldered and circuit board MDN, are pretty cheap. So I was just wondering, is there any reason, can I just connect both of those, a regular SMA and an RP-SMA, to the same place and splice them together to it, as long as I only have one antenna? I just want the flexibility on that, so whenever I have one antenna versus the other, I can switch it and not have to go find an adapter. I'm hoping to travel with the thing, so does that matter? Will that pick up other signals, I guess? Back to you.
That's an interesting thing. You're basically going to have two very, very short leads coming off your hardwired or soldered to your board. So one's going to be one type of small antenna connector in the end, and then you'll have another one going to the same solder, same antenna, hardwire, whatever you want to call it, right there on the board. You'll have two short little leads coming off your PC board or whatever for your antenna. You want to know if having two short leads will affect the performance in any way. That's a good question. I'm not sure of the answer. I would think that as long as you keep the cables fairly short, you probably shouldn't have much interference. Let me stand by here and see if anybody else has an answer to jump in there with. Anybody else keying up there? You know, I'm not 100% sure, but I, like I said, Evan, I think that if you kept the leads short enough that they're not acting as an antenna, I don't think that you would have a problem, especially in that particular application if you're just using it for an antenna for an Echolink node. But, you know, that's a good one, and maybe I'll bring that up with a couple other people and have an answer for you next week. That's just kind of my gut instinct. As long as you keep the leads short, I would think that it would be all right.
KG7GPM.
So there you go. There's a technician. Go ahead, Mike.
Question I have is, are you looking to hook up two different types of antennas, one or two different types of connectors to one antenna system, or so you can have your choice of two different types of antennas, or what? I didn't understand the question.
Yeah, I think that was his question. I'll have him reiterate there. Go ahead, Evan.
That, Mike. Since the whole transition from SMA connectors to RP-SMA, I have mixed sets of antennas, and just depending what I happen to have with me, I just want the flexibility to be able to hook up. I can't remember if they're male or female, but I want to be able to hook up to the SMA or RP-SMA connector, just whatever I have on hand. But internally, that's going to hook to the exact same transceiver. So does it matter, and will it cause interference if I only have an antenna on one and that other, like Glenn said, short inch or two lead is just hanging there, not connected to anything?
Now I understand the question. You're wanting to hook up a SMA and an RS-232 type, two different, so you had a choice of two different antennas, whichever antenna you happen to have with you. If you keep the leads real short, I don't see where there would be a whole lot of problems.
Okay, perfect. That was kind of the avenue I was going to try, but I thought I'd check with some people that have been in the business a bit longer. Or hobby, I guess. No business here on amateur radio. So it's KG7WPM.
We understand what you mean. KG7GPM, back to net.
Thanks, Link. I was trying to think of a way to find the same problem in other forms. Like, I was thinking of like an antenna selector switch. You got one lead coming in, two leads going out, or more than two leads coming out. And I guess when you switch the switch, it actually disengages all the other choices except for the one that you're using. So then I thought of maybe a diplexer, but the diplexer pretty much does the same thing. When it's a certain frequency, it's bypassed one way. When it's another frequency, it goes another way. So I can't even think of another application where the same thing is used, where you have two antenna ports going to the same transceiver and you're only using one at a time. But again, I would think that as long as they're pretty short, you could probably get away with it. But I would also be careful of anything being shorted out on the one that you're not using. That would be a concern there, that it doesn't get grounded out or shorted out against any metal objects while you're using it. So that'll be interesting. I'll poke around this week and see if I can come up with an answer for that. Interesting question and good application. I can see why you're doing it. It totally makes sense. So thanks, Evan. Did you have another question there? Okay, go ahead with the comment there.
Well, the one thing I would recommend is putting in some kind of a toggle switch just so you can switch back and forth between the two antenna connections. That would pretty much eliminate all your problems with the interference or anything like that. You only need like a double pull, double throw switch to switch back and forth.
Okay, thanks, Mike. I will give that a shot. And to Glenn, I did have another question, but I'll wait for a few other people if you want to come back to me. This is KG7WTM, back to net.
Something as small as, you know, SMA connectors, that's going to, you're probably going to want a very tiny switch for very, very tiny coax. But if they make something like that, that would be even more ideal at that point, I think. That's a good point. I don't know if they make something that small for SMA type stuff.
KG7SJR with comment.
Yeah, go ahead, Bill. Welcome to the Omnet.
Thanks, Clint. Hey, back in the day, when I was a very young boy, my hair was dark instead of gray, I worked in a radar shop, and we had essentially caps that would screw onto a lot of our connectors that did not ground the center connector, but isolated them from radio interference, because we were working with some very, very small frequencies. That's how we used to deal with spurious emissions coming into our radar units.
Yeah, if you could get some kind of cap that would terminate the frequency at that point, and again kept your coax or your lead coming off the transceiver very short, that would be pretty ideal. I like the idea of a little AB switch or antenna switch. It'd have to be a tiny little guy for SMA though. That'd be kind of cool.
Roger that. I think we can find a leprechaun who can do that for us.
Well, with these Japanese radios, you know, the big dogs, Icom, Yusu, man, they pack a lot of stuff into a little tiny area there. I think the Japanese could get it done for us.
W7EFS with a question.
Well, go ahead there, Tony.
Well, I'm familiar with the SMA connectors, but reverse polarity SMA, RP SMA, what does that mean, please?
Well, let's turn it over to Evan. He was one playing with the RP SMA.
That's funny, Glenn. My first thought was RPSMA is, what is it, PIA? They're very difficult to throw into the whole mix of things. So it's yet another connector. I can't remember which is which, so you're better off probably looking it up online or at least looking at what you have. But SMA versus RPSMA, they've switched the little male insert on the inside from the female thread. The outside leg on the SMA, you have your male and your female, and then you've got the inside connector that's male and female. And the RP SMA is just which goes with which outside leg set. So it's still, if you get the one that has no male inner on the male thread, you can get something that has no male inner on the female thread, and they'll screw together, but that center connection doesn't connect. And if you get the opposite of those, you get two males that will be hitting on the inside, but yet the outside thread would screw together if those two male insides weren't there. So it's just another kind of connector that helps confuse and run up our bills on adapters, I guess.
W7EFS. And if I understand correctly, like the routers that most people have with an external antenna that you can swivel around, I'm not sure if those are RPSMA. And on an RPSMA, does the signal still travel on the center conductor, or does it actually reverse the polarity and put the signal on the outside, and the center conductor is then the grounding mechanism?
You know, Tony, I'm not really sure. By the name, I would guess that they maybe are actually flipping the purpose of each of that center conductor. But and as far as the Wi-Fi routers, yes, they do also use RPSMA and SMA. So I have 2.4 gigahertz antennas and 5 gigahertz antennas, and my 2-meter antennas and my 70-centimeter antennas, and I've got them in SMA and RPSMA. So, yeah, they come in all flavors.
All right, thank you, Evan. And if I understand your problem correctly or your question correctly, it's how to integrate the two and deal with that signal transition between SMA and reverse polarity SMA. Thank you so much. That's informative. I've got research to do. Gives me something to do to keep me off the streets. W7EFS.
All right, guys, thank you. Thanks, Tony. Thanks, Evan. Thanks, Mike. Everybody. So I think we got that knocked out of the way. It's kind of fun. And I didn't even realize that the routers worked both SMA and RPM SMA. So that's kind of interesting. We'll have to start tearing apart some of the routers I have laying around and taking a look at them just for the heck of it. All right, K1RR is my call sign. I think that was the end of the original questions for the Almanet. So we'll see if anybody else has anything they want to ask or discuss here. And we'll stand by and listen.
KG7WPM. I do have another question, but I'll wait until after everybody else.
VSA with a D-Star question.
PSA and Evan, but then another question. Evan wants to wait, so we'll send it over to you, KG7VSA from K1RR. Go ahead with the D-Star question.
Evening, Glenn West here. Next project I'm looking at possibly tackling is doing a D-Star hotspot, possibly a little HT to be able to trace the D-Star. I'm curious, I know Dust has a hot spot, and I know a couple of others, John Boy also just got one. Just curious what the options are. I know there's the DV dongle, there's the DV mega with a Pi. I'm just wondering what are the better options out there.
Good question. Duff and Randy both, John, you know, they all have different types of hotspots. I think John and Duff actually run the same one. So if you look up DVAP, D-V-A-P stands for Digital Voice Access Point, is a little device, a USB device with a little antenna on it. And that allows you to plug it into a computer, Intel based Macintosh or standard Windows PC. Gives you a D-Star hotspot for your radio. Now you still have to have a D-Star radio. You have to have an internet connection. But it will give you access, basically kind of your own access point. You can connect to all the reflectors, you can do whatever you wish, whenever you wish, and nobody has any other say in it. So that's one way to go. It's a pretty inexpensive box that you can
plug right in. You can also run other hotspots. The DV Mega is something that Mike has a lot of experience with, and I do not. So if you want to look up the DV Dongle, the website that they're talking about them on, is www.dvap, or Digital Voice Access Point, Dongle, D-O-N-G-L-E.com. So D-V-A-P-D-O-N-G-L-E.com. Let me see if Mike's still hanging around, because he's all about the DV Mega. And I'll turn it over to Mike, KG7GPM from K1RR.
The DV Mega plugs into a Raspberry Pi, and that gives you access. But I've got experience with both. If you want to ask questions, go ahead. KG7GPM.
Wes, did you copy Mike? He kind of dropped out there a couple of times. He said he's got experience with both the DVAP and the DV Mega, and if you have any questions, feel free to ask him. Go ahead.
This is KG7DSA. Thanks, Mike, for coming back. Is setting up the DV Mega similar to setting up the Pi RLP? Or, you know, any kind of node using the Pi?
I've never had any experience with the DV Mega, or the IRLP. But the DV Mega is set up pretty much the same as the DVAP and everything. It is the IRC, DVD, gateway, and the dummy repeater.
Guys, that actually answered a bit of questions. I'll do a little bit more research. KG7DSA, back to ElmerNet Control.
Comment, please.
Quick, I'll throw in there. The DV Mega and the Raspberry Pi is a cheaper route to go if you're looking for cost. It's KG7GPM.
Thanks, Mike. Yeah, and I know the Raspberry Pi, well, and the DVAP, the DVAP, both are great for go rigs. Even Craig's got one that he takes in his car with him, and he has a Raspberry Pi in his car. Obviously, the DVAP is going to be a little bit harder when you're running a Windows-based machine to take it with you, unless you're running a laptop with you. But a lot of the guys throw the Raspberry Pis in their cars and then have D-Star even across I-90 at 130 miles an hour. So it seems to work rather well. Go ahead with your comment there, Tony.
Yeah, thank you, Glenn. You expressed it nicely right there with the DV Mega and the Raspberry Pi. A small, compact unit. If you have an internet connection and a Wi-Fi dongle, that internet can be, you know, through your cell phone. And we have what's-his-name, K7NCN, who's on a road trip right now between Gig Harbor and Florida and back again in 4 months. And he is using that mobile. And it's, you know, three of those I've configured, and I'm entirely a fan of them. Of course, people like what they know. the Diva app, I also know some people that are using that. But as you say, that's a USB dongle that can plug into a Pi or a laptop or a desktop, whatever. And it's sticking out. You know, it requires a little bit more support. So they're both 1/10 watt radios. And they are transmitting, of course, through an antenna. There's an SMA connector on there, on the DB Mega at least. The DBAP dongles that I've seen, they've got a little built-in thumb drive antenna, but I'm not sure if that's SMA. But on my DB Mega and Raspberry Pi that I'm running at home, from the SMA connector, I'm going up to a roll-up J-pole antenna from Mighty Fine Junk. And that 1/10 watt signal hanging from the ceiling there through 8 inches of wood on my log walls, that actually propagates quite a ways. I'm very impressed with it, hanging up an antenna on that. And you might be able to do that with the DBAPs too, but they're just not as portable. This one I can take with me and, you know, plug any kind of small antenna into it. So I'm really a fan of the DV Mega and the Raspberry Pis. And on the Raspberry Pi, I'm also running a 1.2 gigahertz receiver for ADS-B aircraft data that I also plug into the internet. The Pi Aware is what it's called. They're just small, compact units that are very nice to play with. Good toys. Guys need more toys. And so do women. Let's get more toys, radio toys, and it's fun stuff. Thank you. W7EFS, back to net control. K1RR.
So thanks, Tony. And yeah, I've talked on both, played with both, but I own neither. I made a big mistake and bought into a very expensive ICOM D-Star for repeater. All ICOM gear. So you got these DVAPs and DV Megas, DV Dongles, all that stuff is a way smarter, way cheaper route to go. But, yeah, so there you go. Let's see, I'll turn it over to Wes again, see if he has any other questions before we move on regarding D-Star and mobile hotspots.
G7 DSA. One quick question for Tony or Jim. Is the routing, since Tony is familiar with IRLP, is the routing similar to doing the IRLP? Do you have to do any port forwarding, VPN? How easy is the setup on that side? G7 DSA.
W7 EFS.
If I'm not mistaken, just from my own knowledge, if I remember correctly, IRLP, you can't use mobile unless you have your own VPN or wireless internet, where, if I remember correctly, with these DVAPs and DV Megas, you can use it anywhere, even hotel Wi-Fi, without any port forwarding, if I'm correct. But we'll see how my answer works out here. Go ahead, Tony.
I agree with you completely, Glenn. If you're going to be mobile IRLP, you need to have a routable address, and that's something where outside people can find you through a routable address, and that can be static or dynamic, but it needs to be a publicly routable address, and that costs money if you're mobile. The nice thing about the D-Star hotspot is that you only need a routable address if you are using the IRC DDB gateway software. I think of that as Internet Relay Chat D-Star Database is the acronym, I think. But that one doesn't need to be enabled on some of the images that can be downloaded. The D-Star Commander is what I've set up here on three nodes recently, and this is what Beth is running. He's the one that introduced me to that, and I'm very grateful for that because it's easy to set up, and it provides easy information too, and it doesn't really use the IRC DDB gateway. It's not enabled if you look at the screen, but it allows you to go ahead and connect outwards to the internet, and people don't have to come in and look at your stuff to see what you're doing, and you don't have to get information from the world. That really adds to costs if you're doing mobile data acquisition. The D-Star Commander doesn't really use the IRC DDB gateway, so you don't have to open any ports. You can use it from home, you can carry it with you, and I'm new to it, but I'm highly in favor of it. W7EFS.
Back to you, Lewis.
Back to you, Glenn, KG7VSA.
Yep, and that's one thing, you know, Lewis, but again, I haven't set up either one of these. I've got to talk on them, and I think they're both really cool. But that's one big downfall to iMobile IRLP is having to have, you know, like with my IRLP in the truck, I have a 3G USB modem for Verizon Wireless, which goes plugged into a cradle point router, and that router has to do all my port forwarding. But with these, whether you're using a DVAP or the DV Mega, well, more of the DV Mega than the DVAP, where you get around using the IRC DDB software. No port forwardings. You can use it anywhere you go. You know, John Boy down there in California pulls up to a McDonald's, which is pretty limited as to what internet they allow through their router. And he can use D-Star just fine through McDonald's and hotels and basically anywhere you can jump on the internet, you can use your DVAP. So, pretty cool stuff compared to IRLP, that's for sure. So, thanks for jumping in here this evening, guys. Good to hear from you. If you have any other questions, feel free to jump back on in. We'll send it back down to Evan again, KG7WPM. This is K1RR.
Hey everybody, KG7WPM. I was wondering, since I'm on the road, how do you guys find repeaters and I want to say IRLP nodes, but I know there's the IRLP website, but how do you figure out what's in your area and what the tones are and the frequency offset? I found an app for an Android phone that I downloaded it, and it looked really good and had lots of stuff, and it was tied into your GPS to tell you how far away stuff was. But most of the records don't seem up to date, and I found a lot of the same online. So is there a better website I should be checking out, or what do you guys recommend?
That's a good question. I guess it depends upon, you know, what you want to do. I'm a big fan of talking to home when I'm on the road. I want to be able to check into the 7 a.m. Northwest Regional and International Net. I'd like to be able to call my own IRLP nodes from wherever I am and rub it in that I'm in 80-degree weather when they're in 30-degree weather and stuff like that. And also, I'm a big fan of IRLP, so usually when I go somewhere, I'm looking for somewhere with IRLP access. They have an app for IRLP for your Android device. I don't know if it's on iOS, but really cool, very handy software called IRLP Finder. And you basically enter your location or use your GPS to set your location, and it scans for IRLP nodes close to you and tells you what their frequency is, what their CTCSS tone requirement is,
what their note number is, tells you what the status is, if it's in use or connected or idle. Really cool software, but that's pretty much just for IRLP. A lot of people use repeaterbook.com. It's a great website to search for repeaters in your area. You can search by features such as, you know, System Fusion, D-Star, IRLP, or Echolink availability, and a lot of times it'll give you, or most of the time it gives you the frequency and PL tone and all that stuff as well, but it's probably not as up-to-date. A lot of old information in repeaterbook.com as well. Let me take a break here, and we'll see if anybody else has any ideas on how to find local repeaters to use when you're out of town.
Comment?
Yeah, go ahead with the comment.
KG7VSA West here. I have two of them. I've downloaded Repeater Book. It's not much more up to date than ARRL's app. They also have one. You have to pay to get your app unlocked. I think it's like a $10 fee, if I remember correctly. And then the newest one I got was R Finder. I find it a little bit more visually appealing. In the list of repeaters that are close to you based on your GPS, it easily displays whether they have an All-Star Link, an IRLP, an Echo Link. However, Repeater Book, for searchability, you can actually narrow it down if you're looking specifically for D-Star 2-meter or D-Star 1 1/4, or IRLP or Echolink. Inside the settings, you can actually narrow down and filter your search much tighter, just like you can on their website. And those are both Android apps. I do believe they also have iOS versions of that. KG7VSA, back to you.
Information. Anybody else want to share how they look up repeaters when they're out of town?
W7EFS. I do have the ARRL repeater directory, and I acquired that by waiting until the last minute to renew my ARRL membership, and they offer some bonuses, one of which was that, including the Android app. They give you an access code to use that. And I do have a question for you, Glenn, although this might be directed to W7OE. He mentioned last Monday that there was a problem after the power outage. Maybe it was the Monday before. Time really flies. There was a power outage up on the Mica Peak repeater, fluctuated, and the controller reset to a tone. And the ARRL repeater directory for the past several years has indicated a tone of 131.8 on that. And yet I've heard from many that there is no tone requirement for that. So that was probably an error within that directory. So anyway, there's many ways to find it, those cell phone apps. One of the things I like, I'll break for a second. One of the things I like about the ID51A ICOM handheld radio is that it has a built-in GPS. And if one turns on that GPS, one can find a selection of the nearest D-Star repeaters to use. And one can select any of those. And I find that very handy when I'm traveling. So that's a new radio for me. I've only had it for about a half a year or so. But I'm really having fun with exploring the features of that. So, yes, Evan, there are many ways to find different repeaters, and they all have errors. All of them. But, you know, one does what one can. Anyway, thank you so much, Evan, for that question. That's very good. Back to net controller, K1RR. This is W7EFS.
Comment, AAT.
TSA or baggage handlers help themselves to my radio. You know, something else I'd really like to stress, and I probably should have thought of this first, is you know, it's fun to expand who you talk to and the contacts you can make on amateur radio, whether you're enjoying VHF, UHF, and repeater operation, or you're into HF, you know, whatever you do, it's always nice to expand, you know, who you talk to, and I try not to limit myself to just one or two repeaters. I try and get out to other clubs and get to know other people from other repeater groups, even in the Spokane area. So I'm one of those guys that has most every repeater that I can reach programmed into my radio. And a lot of times I put it on scan, you know, listening to the same people over and over again gets pretty old after a while, at least to me. So I put my radio into scan mode when I'm just listening. And something I would urge everybody to do is use the calling frequencies. You know, we have national calling frequencies for each mode, each band, whether it's HF, VHF, UHF, whatever the case may be, but for you people using 2 meters, of course I don't do sideband. I do monitor it from time to time, but obviously in scanning, it doesn't work too well with sideband. But put 146.520 into your radio as a memory channel, and put your radio on scan. And that way you pick up the national simplex calling frequency for 2 meters. And I noticed that one time I was in California with just a handheld with a rubber dart, nothing on the outside of a rental car, just driving through, I don't even remember where it was, and I thought, what the heck, I'll try the national simplex calling frequency for 2 meters. Put out my call sign one or two times, and even driving down the highway at 50 or 90 or 130 miles an hour, whatever I was doing, I'll be darned if somebody didn't come back to me. A guy with a Mexican sounding accent, and he was in the local area, and just heard me coming through, and that's a great way to also find repeaters and you know, people with information on the local area. So definitely encourage everybody to do that, and I think a lot of people forget about the national simplex calling frequencies, so just jump on 146.52 and call for anybody that's listening, and I'm sure that when I hear people doing that, I give them a whole list of repeaters and directions to go, depending upon what they want to do or who they want to contact. So put it in your memory channel. And put the radio on scan, even if you're just scanning your favorite repeater and the simplex calling frequency. It definitely helps those folks out that looking for information or somebody to talk to that are in your local area that don't know where to go. So send it back down to you there, Evan. KG7WPM from K1RR.
I'll jump in when I have a chance.
Unfortunately, the stuff just appears to be a little old or incorrect tones or something here or there, but let me know to stop looking, and I'm going down the right path. But I'll try that call frequency. I've only been in town for a few hours yet, so
my main concern was getting called into the ElmerNet tonight and saying hi to back home. But that answers my question. Thank you, guys. This is KG7WPM, back to net.
Yeah, I've been happy to help there, and wish I would have thought of that simplex calling frequency before I did. Having a sneezing attack here. I'm allergic to my own dog. Terrible here. Go ahead there, John Boy.
Hey, thanks, Glenn. There's one thing that comes across all the time where repeater databases aren't always kept up to current. And the one other gentleman was saying that it was showing a tone that was for a particular, maybe a Kabara system, 138, whatever. I do believe that even since there are no tones required for the Kabara system, if you happen to be putting one in because you read it off of a database, it wouldn't matter. You would still be get in. You would still be able to connect in. It doesn't matter. You're just throwing an extraneous tone out there. You can correct me that on the first point. The second one was, you know, what I've always done when I'm going through town and I happen to see a big old monster tri-bander stacked tower, whatever, what I do is I just pull up to the gentleman's house and knock on the door and introduce myself. That way you not only get an eyeball with somebody you've never met, but you say, oh, by the way, do you have a local current repeater frequency list by hand? And, hey, it kills two birds with one stone. KD7AAT.
That's kind of... good idea. I was going to make a joke about it's a lot like how I go antenna shopping when I need a new, especially a mobile antenna. You go to a good ham fest, the bigger the better. And you don't even have to pay to get in. You just wait out in the parking lot till it starts and just unbolt whatever antenna you want off whatever car. Okay, bad joke. No, it's not a bad idea. Yeah, I don't know. I would feel, of course, if you ever see me in person with all the tattoos and stuff, I don't look like the kind of guy that most people want coming to their door to have a talk with, but it's not a half bad idea. But I really stress putting the simplex calling frequencies into your radio. Some of the newer radios come with them built in. And you just flip to a different memory channel and you're right on the calling frequency. But it's probably not as used as much as it was in the past, but it's still a great way to keep it alive, and that's what it's there for, is looking for information and making contacts with somebody really local to you within simplex range. So. And then, to answer Tony's question and to elaborate on your PL tone or CTCSS tone, what happened with the Mica Peak repeater, it defaults to requiring a tone when power is restored to that particular machine. So the power may have been restored to the machine before we actually realized it, because we were not trying to access it with the 100 hertz tone. And that's what the tone is on the 3.8 machine. So I actually made a change into my memory channel, and whenever I talk on the 3.8 now, I am putting out a 100 hertz tone, even though it does not require it. But that way, if the machine ever goes down, I don't have to try and remember that it would require a tone until John goes in and actually modifies one of the settings in the controllers to require no tone. So that's where we went wrong in not knowing when the 3.8, exactly when the 3.8 was restored anyway. And yeah, it doesn't hurt. Like I said, I'm putting out a 100 hertz tone when I'm using the 3.8, even though it does not require it. So there you go.
Hey, K1RR here. Any other questions or comments here for the ElmerNet this evening? Remember, there are no stupid questions.
W7EFS will break in again. Yeah, I wondered where the ARRL got the 131.8 tone then. And as AAT mentioned, it doesn't hurt to have the tone on there. But when the tone is enabled after a power reconnect, then it'd be nice to know that the 100 hertz is the tone to use. So I wonder where the ARRL got that information, because it's been in there since 2013 directory. So it's interesting stuff. Anyway, thank you, W7EFS.
Well, it could have been an old controller. Maybe the controller that Art had on it when Art owned the machine had that particular tone. And unless somebody goes in there and actually changes it or tells the ARRL listing guy or computer to change it to the correct settings, nobody would ever know the difference. So it could have been back from when Art owned the machine, or maybe somebody thought they knew what they were talking about and modified the text in that particular file or something. And most repeaters, the repeater book, you know, once you create an account, you can actually log in and submit changes for any repeater. And they just kind of do it on the trust system, the trust that you will give the right information to the best of your knowledge type thing. So, yeah, if you get in repeaterbook.com, you can actually go in and change the settings for the 147.36 machine. It shows that I'm the owner and I'm the one that's made the last update to it, but anybody can get in there and change it. So who knows where that came from. Thanks, Tony. Thanks for your comments. We also have Dennis in there, KG7PPX. Go ahead, Dennis.
Yeah, hello, Glenn. I just had a real quick question about the 6-meter repeater on Kamiak Butte. Specifically, is it still part of the Kabara system, and is it operational?
Yeah, it's definitely part of the Kabara system. It's owned by J-N7ZUF, operates on a frequency of 53.75 megahertz. That one does require a tone. It's a 100 hertz tone, located up on Kamiak Butte, same spot the 7-4 machine is located. As far as I know, it's operational. J hasn't mentioned anything or any emails have come through saying that it's down. And I know he uses it quite a bit down there in that area. I'm pretty embarrassed to say that there are two bands I have yet to talk on or work anybody on. And one is 160 meters and the other one is 6 meters. But so there you go. If you're on 6 meters, you're on a band that I've never talked on before.
Well, I wouldn't say I'm necessarily on 6 meters. My 40-meter dipole, my transceiver there can tune up that on 6 meters, and, you know, it's a better radio than what I have for 2 meters, so I thought, hey, you know, that'd be kind of cool, set that up, but I can't seem to bring that repeater up, although I can hit it out here on the West Plains on 2 meters, I can actually hear, and I can bring up, you know, the 2-meter repeater out on Kamiak Butte. So it could just be that 40-meter being horizontally polarized and all that, maybe this can't hit that. Although I did program in, there's one, I think, on Micah Peak, a 6-meter repeater, and I can bring that up, but I haven't been able to get anybody to come back to me on that. So anyway, this is a KG7VPX.
Well, good. Hey, you're more good, you can bring up the Micah Peak. Not so good, you can't bring up Kamiak Butte. You know, I don't know, and, you know, like I said, my lack of experience is terrible with 6 meters, and it's something I should probably get on. I know you can buy 6-meter ham sticks, which is what I run for HF in my truck, and I think it would be a lot of fun. You know, you start getting into beam antennas with 6 meters, and you can do some really cool stuff, especially where we live. You know, the northern lights, you know, it's a little far away, but you can get some good aurora propagation. You know, you can do a lot of cool things. They call 6 meters the magic band, and definitely a lot of cool stuff you can do with it. I just, you know, have never had the antenna set up to do it. I've never even tried tuning it up on my off-center fed dipole, so maybe that's something I should do sometime. But I know with a good 6 meter beam, you can do some really cool stuff. That's something I'm looking forward to. Thanks, Dennis. Good to hear from you this evening. Anybody else, any questions or comments for Elmernet this evening?
Take that CWID out of there since it's already connected directly to
a repeater that's already identifying itself. Does that answer your question there, Jim? KG7EFQ from K1RR.
Actually saying, so that's kind of fun too. Thanks, Evan.
on the repeater IDs and comment to heaven.
Well, go ahead, Mike.
KG7GPM for calling. The local repeater over here, the CARS repeater, has two different repeaters linked together, 440 and 2 meter. And if you're talking on the opposite repeater, it sends out the L afterwards in Morse code, so that you know you're on a linked system.
Yeah, and that's actually, I've heard the CARS do that before, and that's kind of cool. That's actually the repeater courtesy tone. What we hear, like if you're on the 3-6 and you transmit, when you're on key, you hear doot, doot. When you're on the 3-8, or someone's on the 3-8 and you're listening onto the 3-6, you hear doot, just one tone instead of the two. And you can tell which repeater that particular transmission came from, whether it was on the repeater you're using or not. The controller that I programmed for Elk Butte, it goes doot-doot when you transmit on it, and when it's incoming, it goes doot-doot. So it's just the opposite. You can tell whether it's incoming or outgoing over the link. And the way that they did theirs is the repeater courtesy tone, instead of just two tones, it goes did-out, did-it. So you can tell that it's an L for the link. But that's kind of cool how the CARS have done that. I've heard that before.
If you want to, you can contact me later on the Echo Link. It's KG7GPM.
Thanks, Evan. Well, we ask one more time, any other questions for the Elmanet this evening?
Question.
Yeah, go ahead with the question.
My question was, if I'm using a little simplex repeater and using it in simplex for a couple of hours or a day or two, do I need to set up a call identifier if I'm only using it for simplex and for a limited time?
I understand the hardware situation. So a simplex repeater, what is a simplex repeater?
It's a little box that you get it off of eBay. You hook it up to a radio, and it records, like, I think, like 2 minute chunks, or up to 2 minute chunks, and then sends it out on another frequency. It's like a little crossband repeater, a little simplex repeater. A lot of individuals use them for base stations or stuff like that, but I was just thinking of using this for simplex and probably for just a limited amount of time rather than a full time, full open repeater, such as device.
Okay, so a store and forward repeater, it stores the information, in this case is audio, and then re-forwards it out again. Any station that originates RF-based data or voice must identify itself.
But if you are the, I have to think about this now. So if you're the control operator, if you're the only one that's using it, and you identify your station every 10 minutes and at the end of the QSO, let's see. As long as you are the control operator and you're the only one that's using it, and you do it yourself, even if you're not in... So let's backtrack here. That would be a repeater operated in, let's see, not local control. It must be, so it's a remote control. You have to have a way to turn it on and off. You must have a way to turn it on and off then with like DTMF tones. That's good. Okay, so it's a station operated in remote control, where you are the control operator. As long as you're the only one that uses it, I don't see why you couldn't, or why you would need one, as long as you identify your station, and it goes out from, you know, obviously your call sign is being heard on the radio that you're using, and when it repeats your call sign out on another band, it's still the same call sign, as long as you do it every 10 minutes, and at the end of each transmission, I think you would be perfectly legal. If somebody else uses it, then I would think that it would need to identify itself with your call sign, since you are the control operator.
The best analogy I could probably come up with to compare it to would be cross-band repeating. If you had a cameo or something in your truck and you're in your house and you got to set up the crossband repeat and you're using it to talk to your buddy, it's the best analogy I can come up with that would be similar to the same use that I would be looking for. Yeah, see, now, that's only the outgoing audio that I'm thinking of. Now, if somebody's talking into you, if it comes in on 440 and then repeats back out in 2 meters to you where you're receiving that traffic, I would think that the station that your device, your store and forward repeater, would have to identify itself. So I would think that... Yeah, on the outgoing audio wouldn't be a problem. The incoming audio may not, because if, let's say I'm calling you through your store and forward repeater, and you don't answer that repeater, but it's still keyed up with my traffic, or my voice, my phone, it would have to, by law, identify itself. Copy that. Thank you. That is quite... informative. Very, very well done. I would probably only turn it on if I was going to be using it. I don't think in the situation I would have it on all the time. So there wouldn't be anybody using it unless I would be the one on, and then that would be the only way it's on. So thank you for that info, because if it's going to be on, it needs to have probably a Morse code or whatever. It needs to identify itself. I understand that. Thank you very much. This is K7, Foxtrot Hotel Juliet, Ken and Colfax, clear monitoring. Thank you.
Yes, again, you still, each transceiver should identify itself. It's like me trying to use the excuse that I don't have to identify my station when I'm talking on the 3-6 machine, because the 3-6 machine is already sending out my call sign every 10 minutes or 6 minutes. But that doesn't work, because you gotta remember that we're amateurs and we identify our stations so everybody knows who we are, but at a time when there's harmful interference, whether it's intentional or accidental, people have to have a way to track down where the traffic is originating from. So even though the repeater itself is transmitting, it's not interfering with anybody, but if I'm talking and my neighbors are hearing me over their television or the radio, and the FCC or OOs or somebody goes to investigate, I can't use the excuse, well, the repeater was identifying my station for me, because that doesn't identify the traffic coming out of the transceiver that I'm using that may be interfering with somebody else. So just another way to look at it, I guess. Thanks for the question. That was kind of fun to have to stop and think about that. All right, about a quarter after 9 here, K1RR. Let's see if we have any more questions or comments for the net.
W7AFS, comment.
Did Echo Link or ILP, IRLP go down? We're not getting anything on the west side.
Yeah, I think at 9 o'clock, we have, we're not supposed to talk about it on the air, but there's somebody that we want to eliminate their ability to transmit so they don't cause problems overnight. And from now on at 9 o'clock at night, East Tiger is shut down. Hope to catch you all again next week. This is K1RR 73.